This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Sam Sanders, in for Shamita Basu. Today, Iran and foreign policy under Trump 2.0. On February 28th, the United States and Israel launched a series of military strikes against Iran, killing the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who had ruled the country for nearly 37 years. Since then, Iran has retaliated and the conflict has spread across the region. At least 6 U.S. troops have been killed. Human rights groups say more than 1,000 Iranian civilians have died in the crossfire. The escalation comes during a presidency already marked by several instances of military action abroad. During his first year back in office, Trump has ordered strikes in multiple countries, including Venezuela, where U.S. forces captured President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. Taken together, it all marks a striking start to Trump's second term on the world stage. And all of it raises really big questions. What exactly is driving Trump's foreign policy right now? How does that continue to play out over the next 3 years of his term? And what does all of this mean for America's role in the world? To help make sense of this moment, I spoke with Susan Glasser. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and she co-authored a book about Donald Trump and his first term in office. It's called The Divider. Susan has been covering American foreign policy and presidential power for decades. We spoke Wednesday morning as the conflict continued to unfold. So to start, I just want to get your initial gut reaction to seeing these Iran attacks begin. In those first moments, what were your first thoughts?
I actually did get up in the middle of the night, overnight from Friday to Saturday. And, you know, it was this sort of both inevitability, like on some level, it was always going to come to this. And also a sense like, you know, this is this moment once again when Donald Trump is really rolling the dice. This is a very risky thing he chose to do. It's a real escalation from Trump 1.0. And, you know, the guy who you and I might look at those eviscerating poll numbers, the criticism that he's getting, the questions all around, the Supreme Court literally wiping out the foundations of your economic policy. And, you know, somebody else might
take a loss and say, let me go right? Be quiet, you know, for a little bit.
Pivot a little bit. To me, it's very Donald Trump that the response is to escalate in such a dramatic and consequential way.
Yeah. You know, you have been writing about any semblance of a foreign policy doctrine that Trump and this White House might have. It's hard to pin it down because of some of the characteristics that you just mentioned. But before Trump attacked Iran, you did, in some of your writing, sum up his foreign policy with the following words. You said Trump, quote, looks at territory on a map and says he wants to own it. Trump could not articulate a rationale for acquiring Greenland, no more than he can elaborate on what his plan is for Venezuela. You wrote that before he attacked Iran. Do you still stand by that assessment of his foreign policy doctrine, seeing things on a map and saying, why not?
I mean, that's a part of it. There's no question. And that's Trump in his own words to us, actually, back in 2021, when we were working on this book, The Divider, about Trump's first term in office. And Greenland, back in his first term, kind of played as a laugh line when it came public in the summer of 2019 as sort of one of these crazy Trump one-offs, a Twitter meme. But it actually wasn't. It had turned out when we did this reporting that it was a long-held preoccupation of his once he was told about it by his old college buddy, the philanthropist Ron Lauder. And to me, that Trump fixation was fascinating. And I asked him about it in one of our two interviews with him in Mar-a-Lago for this book. And Trump said, essentially, I'm a map guy and I'm a real estate guy. And I look at the map and I see, you know, how massive Greenland is. And I say, I've got to have it. And for me, that was just a really important insight, especially in Trump's second term. He's a man who's very palpably, it seems to me, seeking for legacy, right? Donald Trump right now, he's slapping his name all over buildings in Washington. That's where
his image on buildings in Washington as well.
Oh my goodness. You know, and this is remarkable. He is a guy in legacy mode, it seems to me, far more than he's a guy in short-term politics advantage mode. Yeah. And in that context, I think it's important to look at some of the foreign policy moves, things that he thought about doing, perhaps that he really wanted to do in his first term, but was constrained either by the politics or by his advisors in his first term. Mm-hmm. So there's so many differences, but I think an important difference for us is this is a man in search of legacy. And you know what? The Ayatollahs in Iran have defied the United States for most of Donald Trump's adult lifetime, since 1979. Mm. And he's seen previous presidents as losers, as weak, as people who failed to take on the tough challenge of getting rid of this sort of malign force in the world. And again, to me, that plays to his sense of glory.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Trump has attacked seven nations during his second term so far. And I want you to tell me how Iran feels different. How is a strike in Iran right now different than, say, Venezuela or some of the other things he's done since he's been back in office?
Yeah, it's very, very different. First of all, it's not just a single set of strikes or an isolated moment in time, but even now, you know, we're on the fourth, fifth day of the war here. It's a war. It is, in fact, a rapidly metastasizing regional war in the Middle East. And it's already grown with Iran's retaliatory strikes on an array of U.S. allies and partners across the Gulf to being the biggest regional conflict in the Middle East in decades.
Yeah.
The bottom line is the U.S. has created an array of military and strategic partnerships and business partnerships across the countries of the Persian Gulf, you know, in places like Qatar is the biggest U.S. airbase there. Obviously, you know, for decades going back to Franklin Roosevelt, the U.S. has had a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, maintains a military presence, and that U.S. Fifth Fleet is headquarters in Bahrain. But Iran chose to go after not just U.S. military targets in those countries. And I think this is really notable. They're going after civilian targets. They're blasting away at, you know, the Fairmont Hotel in Dubai.
Wow.
They actually even went after Oman, which is the one country in the region that had been brokering the very obviously unsuccessful peace talks between the U.S. and Iran. They bombed them days after it was the Omani foreign ministry that was hosting the back and forth between the U.S. and Iranian mediators. So they've escalated in response in a way that is very volatile. And of course, you have the incredible amount of the world's energy supplies that are transiting the Strait of Hormuz. And you're really putting a big chunk, not just of security, but of the world's commercial shipping and energy supplies at risk. So the consequences of this decision from Donald Trump are very different than when he launches a one-off strike over Christmas vacation, you know, in Nigeria, or when he is going after rebels in Yemen once or twice. It's just, it's the order of magnitude here is much greater.
Yeah, yeah. It has been remarkable to see the ways in which Donald Trump and his White House have tried to explain their attack on Iran with multiple different reasons and explanations. Can you run through their justifications briefly and tell me which one you believe?
Well, we're talking on a Wednesday morning, and depending on the person, you might have a different count. I came up with six or seven rationales 2 days ago. Others, I think, have gone up to 10. You know, it depends what you count as a separate rationale. The most important thing about this barrage of conflicting objectives and reasons and, in many ways, pretexts for the war is the basic observation, going back to Clausewitz, right, that you can't win a war whose goal you cannot define, right? You must be clear going into a conflict what it is you hope to achieve by it. And here we have Donald Trump in the initial hours as the strikes began releasing an 8-minute video on his social media platform, essentially outright calling for regime change as the goal of this operation. A remarkable statement from a politician, a president whose entire career in public life has been defined by the chance of no new wars and the stupidity that he claims that all of his predecessors had in getting the United States enmeshed in what he called forever wars, endless wars in the Middle East. And so for Trump to not only launch a war of choice in the Middle East, but to do so by outright calling at its inception for regime change, truly a remarkable moment in American politics. But his advisors, and at times Trump himself, have been walking that regime change goal back ever since.
Yes. I want to say, was it Pete Hegseth, his defense secretary? He kind of played with that regime change language himself, no?
Well, this was a really, again, a remarkable moment. It had, to me, listening to Pete Hegseth, who came out and spoke to the media on Monday morning along with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So they let a war go on for two full days without the leadership of the Pentagon speaking to the American people. Again, I've watched decades of national security leaders in both parties in Washington. This is not how it was supposed to work in America, a democratic country. 2 days of war without any explanation. So he comes out there on Monday morning, and it was almost like, I thought, Hegseth, as if he was like playing the role of Colin Jost on Saturday Night Live, playing Hegseth, because he just basically starts shouting at the media, shouting these kind of belligerent slogans without any of them really making much sense. And to your point on regime change, he says,
"This is not a so-called regime change war, but the regime sure did change. And the world is better off for it."
This is just, it seems to me, the kind of bellicose hair splitting of someone who's desperate not to, you know, offend that audience of one, Donald Trump. So they can never admit that the boss was wrong, except that they want to tell you that the boss was wrong. And so that creates this built-in dilemma for Hegseth and Marco Rubio that we're seeing drive their very incoherent public messaging.
Yeah. It is hard to talk about why this is happening without talking about the involvement of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu. He is close to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is very popular in Israel. How does Netanyahu play into all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is an operation that, you know, Trump prefers not to emphasize this, but this is an operation, a joint operation with Israel. Normally, in other conflicts in the region, you know, we've had an array of democratic allies and partners. But this time, the United States is not fighting with Great Britain. It's not fighting with France and Germany and our other, you know, friends and allies and partners in NATO, but solely with Israel. And we've heard some conflicting things, again, from the administration about the role of Israel. At one point, when there was sort of an outcry here in Washington about why now in this conflict, because to justify a war, legally speaking, you're supposed to have either responding to an attack, which did not happen here, or be able to offer evidence of a credible imminent threat. So the other day, Marco Rubio said, well, yes, there was an imminent threat on the United States.
There absolutely was an imminent threat. And the imminent threat was that we knew that if Iran was attacked, and we believed they would be attacked, that they would immediately come after us.
Because we knew that Israel was going to launch this war with or without us, and therefore Iran was going to attack us in response. So that constituted the imminent threat. Well, people immediately jumped on that for a whole variety of reasons, as you might imagine. Yeah. One of which was that it made the Trump administration look weak, as if they could not control Israel, as if Israel was going to not listen to the United States despite the billions of dollars in assistance, despite the partnership. And so, you know, Donald Trump then comes out the next day and basically says, yeah, Marco was wrong.
Mr. President, did Israel force your hand to launch these strikes against Iran? Did Netanyahu pull the United States into this war?
No, I might have forced their hands. You see, we were having negotiations with these lunatics, and it was my opinion that they were going to attack first. They were going to attack. If we didn't do it, they were going to attack first. I felt strongly about that.
So strip aside that bluster. What do we know? We know that the U.S. and Israel are in this together without other allies. We know that it is in very much in the perceived political interest of Benjamin Netanyahu to have this war going on. He faces an election later this year. He is already Israel's longest serving prime minister. He wishes to keep in power. He is, as Trump is in the United States, an extremely divisive and controversial figure at home. At the same time, because of the security threats that Israel has faced after October 7th, you know, the war still not entirely finished in Gaza with Hamas, Netanyahu has very skillfully used the existential security threats really as his rationale to hold on to power for on and off for the last few decades. Mm-hmm. And I think there was really a strong perception that this is a conflict he wanted, and also that both the United States and Israel see Iran at its weakest point in many, many years. So, you know, Trump and his advisors right now are telling the American people, essentially, Iran is so strong and so dangerous and such a threat, we needed to mount this war. But the truth is, if you ask any real analyst of the region, anyone who understands Iran, it's actually the opportunity presented by Iranian weakness that probably dictated the timing of this.
It is really interesting to see the ways in which Marco Rubio talks about the Trump administration's foreign policy objectives. There's this massive speech he gave at the Munich Security Conference in February where he lays out what seems to be the most explicit explanation around a Trump foreign policy doctrine. And it harkens back to a different kind of era of what America means, no?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Now, first of all, I should say I am a bit allergic to the use of the, you know, capital T, capital D, Trump doctrine ideas, in part because I think people often overstate the role of ideology or, you know, a coherent theory of the case from Donald Trump, who largely is a gut player, who is willing to embrace a set of policies and then reject them the very next day. And frankly, this war with Iran is underscoring that view. And I hope that it shows to people that they should no longer over-attribute some, you know, coherent worldview to Donald Trump, the man who campaigned against war, who literally chanted, no new wars, no new wars.
And who campaigned for the Nobel Peace Prize for a while, too.
No doubt. So I just want to say that, first of all, you know, Trump doctrine, beware. But I do think Marco Rubio, what he is proposing and suggesting that is Donald Trump's foreign policy worldview is essentially a reversion to a kind of pre-20th century concert of great powers, an idea that there are spheres of influence, that there's only a small number of great powers in the world. They should essentially divide up the world and have a free hand within their own sphere of influence to operate. Rubio's speech in Munich that you mentioned layered on a heavy dose of what you might call kind of white man civilizational
supremacy. That's the thing, the language.
Yeah.
Can I lay out some of the lines that he says in this speech? Because it's, the language was quite interesting. At one point, Rubio says in this speech at the Munich Security Conference, quote, "For five centuries before the end of the Second World War, the West had been expanding. Its missionaries, its pilgrims, its soldiers, its explorers pouring out from its shores to cross oceans, settle new continents, build vast empires extending out across the globe." Then he goes on to say that those were the good times and we should kind of go back there.
Thank you so much, Sam, for reading that quote. Can I just tell you, actually, my writing partner is my husband, Peter Baker, from the New York Times. And he and I literally for the last 3 weeks have been like, how come nobody is really focusing on this is the 250th anniversary of the United States of America, a country founded on the idea of rejecting European colonialism and imperialism. Mm-hmm. That is literally why we were founded. So the nihilistic, ahistorical, you know, and in a way, almost sort of racist vision of America as this kind of European colonial power. It's just like, it's the most bizarre and really pernicious vision of American history. And why is that relevant? Well, just a few weeks later, the administration launches this really significant war of choice, upending not only the Middle East, but in many ways that, you know, a lot of settled expectations about the world right now.
Mm-hmm. Are there any pockets of resistance that could restrain Donald Trump right now? Who could restrain Trump if they wanted to?
You know, I think you're right to spotlight this question. And it goes to the broader question of Trump a year into his second term, asserting sweeping executive powers, both domestically and internationally, that really almost no other presidents have claimed to this extent. Now, many presidents have, despite the Constitution giving Congress the explicit job of authorizing war, many presidents have gone to war asserting that they had the ability to do so. But, you know, this is a notable difference, we should say, between Trump and George W. Bush in the preemptive war of choice decision to invade Iraq in 2003. Let's not forget that it was many Democrats as well as Republicans who explicitly authorized the use of military force in that instance. Mm-hmm. It is also true that Bush and his advisors took great pains to try to sell that need for that conflict to the American public, to the United Nations. Now, you can say, well, they went to war on a false pretext. This is obviously a catastrophic foreign policy decision. But it seems the historical record strongly suggests that many, if not all, of Bush advisors actually believed that there really were weapons of mass destruction. Colin Powell gave that speech to the United Nations on evidence that later turned out not to be correct. But, you know, there's no suggestion at all that Colin Powell didn't believe what he was saying. And so that was a foreign policy mistake of epic proportions. It was a failure. But even so, I think you see how much America has changed and how much our politics and our, frankly, our checks and balances have been eroded in the 20 years between these two operations. Now Donald Trump doesn't bother to go to Congress, doesn't bother to go to the United Nations, basically flouts the American people. Remember that his State of the Union address was just literally a couple days before he launched the war. He had already built up this enormous armada, this enormous, vast American land, sea, and air power in the Middle East. And it was clear that we were headed towards some confrontation with Iran. Trump gave only a few sentences of attention to it in his State of the Union address.
My preference is to solve this problem through diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are by far, to have a nuclear weapon. Can't let that happen.
And frankly, what was the takeaway? The takeaway was that we may or may not go to war with Iran to obliterate a nuclear program that also, he claimed in the same speech, he had already obliterated. You know, so most people in hindsight, including many Republicans, believe George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq was a terrible mistake. You could say that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance became president and vice president in part because of the backlash to that decision within their own Republican Party. And yet, Bush did so much more to observe the norms of American politics, to follow the checks and balances that are built into our system. So, you know, you ask this question, well, what, if anything, could constrain Donald Trump? You know, money talks for Trump. The prospect of metastasizing conflict, oil prices going through the roof, that's a constraint that's real. Yeah.
You know, part of me wonders, we're already seeing oil prices go up over these attacks. We're seeing the stock market begin to fluctuate. Is there a moment in which the business leaders just get Trump in a room and say, you got to stop because of our bottom line?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Trump is very jittery here. In my view, he's bit off this enormous, you know, potential quagmire, but in part because I think he took a lesson from previous failed military engagements. And one of the lessons from him, from Bush's war in Iraq or the conflict in Afghanistan that went on for 20 years or his own previous decisions to launch military strikes, is get in, get out quickly, no boots on the ground. And I think he was attracted, as other presidents have been, to the kind of seductive logic or idea that this incredible American military capacity could rain down kind of cost-free, blood-free change from the sky. And so he's a performatively macho guy. I think he's always been drawn to kind of performative displays of American military might. It's part of his, you know, wanting to appear as a strong man and the leader of a strong country. So I think he thought airstrikes could do the job, first of all. And then second of all, there's this notion of what does Donald Trump mean by regime change? It's probably not what you and I mean by regime change. He looks at this model where he just greenlighted this dramatic military raid to capture and extradite the leader of Venezuela's dictatorship, Nicolas Maduro, at the beginning of this year, extract him. What did he do afterwards? He immediately abandoned America's long-held support for the democratic opposition in Venezuela, despite America having recognized the leader of that opposition as the winner of the last presidential election, and cut a deal with Maduro's vice president and the entire regime to remain in power. And Trump has already spoken of the Venezuela scenario as, quote, the perfect scenario. He used that language in an interview with the New York Times this week for Iran. So that would mean abandoning these incredibly brave protesters in Iran who have risked their lives. And, you know, we haven't mentioned that. So I think it's important to say, like, you know, Iran is a terrible dictatorship, a malign dictatorship, both to its own people internally and to people in the region and around the world. It has been a major state sponsor of terrorism.
I'm in Los Angeles, the highest concentration of Iranians outside of Iran, and it is a celebration in parts of this city.
Absolutely.
Over that guy being gone.
Absolutely, as it should be. I mean, really, right? You know, in your and I entire lifetime, basically, you know, Iran has been, Khamenei was at the very forefront of this government, which chose not only to launch terror campaigns against the United States and Israel, but was a malign force in the region. And just a few weeks ago, thousands of protesters were killed by their own government inside Iran. The numbers are not yet clear. Human rights groups have verified something like 7,000 dead people. Donald Trump used the number of possibly more than 30,000 in his State of the Union address. Either number is far higher than many of the worst atrocities we've seen in recent years. Tiananmen Square, for example, in China, was something like a few thousand protesters who were killed by their own government.
Yeah, yeah. How does life for the average American change if Trump continues on this path? I still feel like it's very easy for Americans to ignore these headlines of war if they want to and just go about their days. Does that change at some point? Is there a physical and material change to American daily life that will be introduced to us at some point if Trump keeps down this path?
I think the price at the pump is the obvious reason why the U.S. for decades has been again and again and again sucked into these conflicts. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember Barack Obama, Donald Trump first term, Joe Biden pivoting away from the Middle East, pivoting to Asia in their foreign policy.
Yeah.
And, you know, seeing China as the long-term pacing threat, the long-term competitor, adversary. And again and again and again, we've been pulled back. As I was a little child in the 1970s during the gas crises, I remember waiting online at the gas station for hours with my dad in our family station wagon. You know, this is how Americans experience this kind of a crisis in the Middle East, first and foremost, is at the gas pump. So that's number one. Number two, when the price of energy goes up, the price of a lot of other things goes up again as well, because energy is the underpinning of our economy. There's also inflation rates, which Donald Trump always wants to have low. Remember, that's been his feud with his Federal Reserve chair for many, many years.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that he loses control of potentially in a situation like this.
If Trump continues to enact foreign policy the way he's done so far, where does that leave the U.S. in 2028 when he leaves office?
Well, I'm glad you're taking it as a given that he will, as the Constitution prescribes, leave office in 2028. I think it's going to be really different than when Trump was defeated and left office very unwillingly after his first term, I think Joe Biden campaigned and won in part on this idea that there could be a kind of a return to normalcy, and that included in foreign policy. So I think allies and partners are going to be much more sanguine, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House next time. I think they're going to understand that a country that could vote for Donald Trump twice is a much less reliable partner than they had thought. And they're going to be looking for the through lines as well as the discontinuities with what Trump has been doing.
Yeah. I keep thinking back to a speech delivered by Mark Carney, Prime Minister of Canada, at Davos this year. And he kind of summarized this whole moment as the end of a rules-based international order that we've all become accustomed to. That is done. That is happening.
It seems that every day we're reminded that we live in an era of great power rivalry, that the rules-based order is fading, that the strong can do what they can and the weak must suffer what they must.
And whether Trump leaves and whoever's next, that just might be where we are for a while.
Yeah, it's interesting. In Trump 1.0, people worried about that. And then in Trump 2.0, it happened.
Wow.
And I think Mark Carney, you know, he said it's kind of a fairy tale that so many of us were clinging on to for years because it was better than the alternative. And now I think you see the countries he calls the middle powers, who are historically our closest friends and partners in the world, they're looking for an alternative. They're, you know, trying to take the rose-tinted glasses off about the United States. And in some ways, that's a bigger loss for us as a country than almost anything else, is that sense that we were actually maybe sort of exceptional, the place that people wanted to come to, the place that people turned to by default to lead. And I think you and I were probably lucky in hindsight that we, you know, came of age at a time when America did occupy that privileged space in the world. And I think, you know, our kids or grandkids will not necessarily have that as their default birthright.
Wow. Thank you for laying this out in such a clear and understandable way. And thank you so much.
Well, Sam, I appreciate the chance to talk with you. Thank you.
We'll include a link to Susan Glasser's reporting for The New Yorker on our show notes page. And every weekend, you can find new episodes of Apple News in Conversation in the Apple News app. Just tap on the audio tab, the little headphones at the bottom, to find it.